Welcome to Cuentos de mi Familia, an oral history project about the stories and the people that make us who we are. I'm Javier, and I'm sitting with my mom, Cuca, and we have a special guest today, my prima, Rosa Robledo, who is with us for a very particular reason. First of all, we wanted to let you in on this project, which we intend to share widely with the family. That's the spirit of the whole thing. But specifically, we'd like to dedicate this episode to your father.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, my tío Chemo, who I remember very fondly. But of course, and this is always my kind of point of frustration with the way the generations worked out. I'm younger. I'm like too young. And so I never met, as we've said before in the podcast, right? I didn't get to meet my grandfather, Ismael. And my tíos, both Alfredo and Chemo, were already older when I was very young. And so I feel like this is one place where I have so much to learn. Like there's so many stories that we can share. Why don't we start with you, Mama? Can you tell us a little bit about how you remember Tío Chemo? What stands out to you about him as a person? Where was he in your life?
I was blessed in my life to be around and be with both of my brothers at an older time in my life. Mm-hmm. So my oldest brother, Alfredo, was 17 years older than I. And Chemo, who was the next in the family, Anselmo Miguel Robledo Benavides, whom we are remembering today, stands out in my immediate family as a wealth of compassion and kindness and joy. You know, he liked to make us laugh. You know, would do so in any and every way that he knew how. You know, I remember him always coming up to me and sort of grabbing, you know, the top of my head and
to scratch your head or mess up your hair?
Mess up my hair. And, you know, it was just this wonderful openness to connecting with the family.
Yes.
He and Alfredo, actually, because they were so much older than I was, had already left the family, both of them, to join the U.S. Army by the time that I was one or two. Mm-hmm. And so I had the good fortune then of meeting them as my older siblings.
Okay.
And being fortunate enough to sort of receive the warmth that came from both of them in a different way than I was used to. It was very nice.
So you became close as adults?
As adults.
You didn't grow up together at all?
We did not.
The connection grew between grown people.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, some might think about that as a loss. I don't. It's sort of, you know, the way I think about you, Javier and Ismael, mm-hmm. that I get to be with you and know you as adults, yes. as adult men, with your own way of being.
Right.
And Chemo's way of being was this very kind, compassionate soul who would take the shirt off his back to help anyone in the family and anyone that he knew that he could help.
That's wonderful. And that reminds me of my relationship with my brother. Of course, I grew up with Ismael, but we're so different from one another that we couldn't really enjoy each other growing up. And it wasn't until we were both adults and began to appreciate the ways that we were similar and the ways that we were connected, that only the kind of experiences and wisdom of adulthood can give you that. Yes. That's when I feel like we really became brothers. My mother, Rosita, was so anxious when we were kids, my brother, that we would not be brothers, right? Because she had this philosophy of you're each other's soulmates. Like, this is who you have. Like, long after we're gone, y'all have to be brothers. But we were always at each other's throat. She was very anxious. And then we've become connected as adults, a little bit like you're describing with the Ocello.
Yes.
Yeah. And that kindness, too. You've told me that before, that he was the kind one. Not that anybody else was mean.
That was definitely, I think if there was one core description, one core word, mm-hmm. it would be kindness. Mm. Definitely. I think everybody in the family felt that. And I don't care if you were older mm-hmm. or the little one, he would find a way of connecting in that warmth.
Yeah.
And he did that even with strangers. Like, one of the favorite memories I have always is my mother used to say, Anselmo, ni a misa te puedo llevar. I can't even take you to church, because he would find the babies.
Oh,
he wouldn't play. And that was just who he was.
So he wasn't shy.
Not as
strong as a shy person.
No, he was reserved.
Okay.
He was a listener.
Mm-hmm.
He was a listener. He was an observer. But never shy.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially with family, yes, the playing with the hair, that was standard.
Right.
Could not stand next to my father without having your hair
right.
You know, messed up, because that's how that was his first connection to you.
Yeah.
And having him grab you and bring you into his arms right. And, ¿cómo estás? And, you know, rubbing your hair and that kind of, that was him. That was his, that's how you knew he was there.
So he was physical.
Very.
He was very comfortable physically.
And very.
Felt connected to people. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So tell us, Rosita, a little bit about who you are and your siblings, and give us a picture of your side of the family.
So we are three. I am the oldest and the only girl. And then I have my brother, who passed 3 years ago, Anselmo, named after my father, and the youngest brother, Mario.
Mm-hmm.
And Anselmo and I are 3 years in difference, and Mario and I are 10 years in difference. So we had a lot. They're very similar to what the Akuka had. And I, too, came to really appreciate that relationship with Mario as an adult. Anselmo and I were always at each other's throat. He was I was a disciplinarian, and he was a fun one.
Oh, so you were serious.
I was that way. And my father would tease us, because they would go, for example, to the school, you know, meet the teacher nights. And my brother would go, you never do anything wrong. I'm always the one. And all the teachers, you can't be Rosa's brother. And my father, pórtate como tu hermana. But again, girl and boy, you know, and the difference of how they treated us was very apparent.
I see.
Middle child syndrome.
So correct me if I'm wrong. Kind of the impression I have is that, in terms of like who ended up like whom, your mother was more serious, mm-hmm. and you were like her, yes. and your father was a little more fun-loving, and so your brother was like him. Is that right?
That is absolutely okay. correct, yes. Okay. And my younger brother is definitely a nice mix of both.
A mix, yes. Yeah. Like, they finally got it right.
Yes. And again, I think that led very typical Hispanic home, where, because I was a girl, you hold on to your mom's skirt and you learn from mom how to be a young lady.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy is cultivated by the male. The
sure.
And so Anselmo, when he was younger, had that always with dad.
Yes.
I got to really know my father as I started growing up into being a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
That's when my father and I really, really connected. I grew up with a father who very often would, if something was happening in my life, he would say, he explained to me very early on that he had two personas in my life. One was that of a father,
mm-hmm.
and the other was that of a man.
He.
And so when there would be something such as dating or anything, like, he'd go, okay, sit down, we're going to have a talk, and I'm talking to you as your father. And then he would give me the litany, the father litany. And then there were days where he would say, I'm now talking to you as a man, and would talk to me in a very, you know, forceful, this is what men are thinking, this is what's happening, this is why you're being treated this way. And so that it was those teenage years where I bonded with my father and under those tributes.
Sure. Yeah. That's cool. So what about before you came along, before your siblings came along? And this is kind of a question for both of you, I suppose. Like, what do you remember about Theo Chemo's life earlier on, right? Like the circumstances of his growing up, the army, I know, is part of the story, meeting his wife, Rosa. What stands out there?
Well, for myself, you know, I very clearly remember Chemo bringing your mom, so my brother bringing his soon-to-be wife to our house in Laredo, 307 South Buena Vista, where I was raised. And it was like a big deal because Rosa was coming, and my mother had known Rosa's family. You know, they were from Nuevo Laredo and kind of knew who's who and what's what. So there was some connection. And so it was like a big deal. And I remember your mom coming over and everybody being at their best, you know, the house was clean and everybody was trying to make a good impression.
So how old were you at this time? About?
I must have been, let's see, I think Chemo and Rosa might have been, I might have been about 7 or 8. Would that make sense?
Yes.
When they got married. And so I remember that day very, very clearly, just because there was so much anticipation and so much preparation. And I had not been a part of that in relation to my older brother. I don't know when or how that occurred, but there was no grand, you know, coming into the house. And
like when he met Enedina and planning to get married.
Right.
Okay.
Right. But that always stayed with me.
So they actually, my mother and father lived in the same neighborhood, a couple of blocks from each other, and had actually grown up together and knew each other as children.
Oh, okay.
And then my father went off to the army, and in one of his visits, saw my mother again, who, by the way, was dating somebody else.
Uh-huh.
And my father's, he would always make sure that we remembered que se la había quitado al otro.
I thought you were going to say the opposite, that he resented the
he
stole her away.
Because he would say, I would come down every so often to see my parents. He was in the army, so he would drive, you know, hours and hours to come in. And so he said, I didn't have much of a chance. It was a do it now or she's going to be gone.
Oh, I see.
You know?
A short window.
Yeah. So they actually dated only 3 months.
Before getting married?
Before getting married.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Before it.
Yes.
Was that all on one, like, bit of leave from the army?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, that's fantastic. Yes. So where was he when he was in the army? Where was he stationed?
So at that time, they were in Killeen.
Okay.
Killeen, Texas.
Okay.
And after they got married, they were shipped to Germany.
Yes.
Right away.
Mm. Oh. And the first memory that I have of you, Micha, is in a beach in Spain somewhere, and you were sitting by the beach and you have a little pail and these really cute little colitas.
It's a photo?
It's a photo.
A photo.
And you're about 3-4 years old. Just this beautiful baby girl playing in the sands of Spain. And of course it's like, you know, this is not like a usual thing for people from Laredo.
Yeah.
Certainly wasn't in my world. Mm-hmm. So that was great.
So were you born in Europe?
No, I was not. Actually, my mother ended up being shipped back to the United States because there were complications with a pregnancy.
Uh-huh.
And my mother was actually unconscious when I was born.
No kidding.
Yeah, she had a rupture of an ulcer. And so coincidentally, my mother's name was also Rosa. We're both Rosa. We're both Rosa Marias. And the reason that I'm called Rosa Maria is because my father was told that both my mother and I may not make it, and that he should baptize me right there and then. And my mother had picked the name Zoraida for me.
Wow.
But he ignored that and named me after my mother right there and then in the hospital.
Okay.
That's how I ended up with her name. And so mom was actually unconscious for a couple of months after that. And dad was the one that took me home. And my grandfather, my mother's father, helped with that, because he had to shortly, in a couple of months was going to leave. They didn't know how long my mom would be in the hospital. But my mother says she remembers my father carrying me, and she would look out the hospital window because she was there for a while. She had lost a lot of weight and was very weak. And that he would just raise me up. Here she is. She's okay, So for the first couple of months, it was dad that would watch after me.
That's really unique.
Yeah.
So where was it? Was it in Texas?
So he came back over here for the birth.
Okay.
So I was born in Laredo.
Okay. Mm. And then once she was well again, did y'all go back to Europe?
Went back over there.
Okay.
And stayed there for another 3 years where my brother Anselmo was born.
Oh, wow.
Anselmo was born in Germany.
Okay.
And then a year later, we all came back.
Okay. So all three of you came into being as part of that sort of traveling the world, phase of y'all's life as a family. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So once your youngest brother had been born and you came back to the United States.
So it was Anselmo that was born in Germany. Mario still wasn't born. Remember, he was born 10 years later.
Oh, so it wasn't all. Oh, that's right. You said 10 years. The two of you were the only.
And then we came back. Mm-hmm.
So what was it like after you came back? Do you remember?
Dad's inspiration for us, mm-hmm. And especially I think for me as a young girl, was Tia Cuca. The educational part was very important. And so I very quickly was put into a quote unquote daycare pre-kinder kind of program, mm-hmm. that was a block away from where we lived. It was a school home. And for dad, getting that English in and getting, because my first language was a dual of German and Spanish. In order to be able to communicate with the children in Germany, I had picked up some German, which I don't remember very much. Very few words. Coincidentally, my son picked it up from the stories that I've shared with him. So he's now trilingual. But my dad wanted me to be able to have that English as a very strong background for my education. And he would tell me how I would hear, it's funny because they didn't grow up together, but he knew a lot about her as a child because he would say that he would remember he was like the father that my grandmother would talk about. He would, you're going to take, porque si nos pasa algo, tú vas a tener que cuidar a tus hermanitas. And they would always talk about the two.
Wow.
He always said Alfredo was a little bit more of the I'm everywhere, flitter, flighter, that kind of personality. And so Anselmo would be the one to lead the rest of the family together. And so he grew up hearing a lot of her academic successes and that kind of thing. And so he would share those with us. And so that was how he wanted us to grow up.
Wow.
So this strong sense of the importance of education and self-being,
Yes, yes. Were you conscious of that, Mommy? The fact that he was being told how you were doing and was really connected in that way?
No. Wow. No. I this is the first time I hear it. It doesn't surprise me. And it is the case that Chemo was seen to be more sort of count-honorable.
I guess one way to
say that. And
compared to Alfredo?
Compared to Alfredo, who was, what did you say? What words did you use? Flighty.
Flighty.
They were both very kind men. Mm-hmm. They took after my dad. both Alfredo and Chemo. But Alfredo was a little more like my mom in terms of being a little more, he separated himself a little more. And in what he also was like my mom, expecting much of each one, demanding much of each in the family. And so you always were a little bit concerned that you weren't quite meeting
the standard.
The standard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas Chemo, you would always feel like who you were and whatever you were was good and it was great. And so I'm happy to hear that this story, which is new to me, about how that was seen, you know, if something should happen to my parents. I do remember that your dad, Rosita, would send, he sent rings from Germany to my mom and dad to my mom for the 25th anniversary.
Oh, really?
And he sent us, you know, those little cuckoo clocks, that very German cuckoo clocks that we used to have at the house that came from Chemo. And there was sort of more of a presence of Chemo in a way in our household.
Right. So you didn't get that vibe at all from him, like Alfredo, that he was kind of demanding, had high standards, was maybe a little moralistic. That's just not who he was.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I think that came from, like I said before, Dad was an observer. And so he, in that sense, he reminds me a lot of Tia Cuca, is that he wanted to know your story.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to hear you. He wanted, you both share that no matter who's around you, you feel like you're the only one present when you're speaking with them. Dad and Tia Cuca had that part in their personality.
Right, right, right. This sounds a lot like our conversation about Ismael, about my abuelito, Ismael, and that kind of like sort of deep listener, really interested in the other kind of person, which is different than my abuelita Lala, who was the intense, the kind of demanding.
Yes.
Just interesting the way the families are a mix.
Right. Cool. And, you know, we talked about, in terms of my dad, how he loved his cafecito, and he would go, you know, to different houses, parts of the family home, and spend some time and drink a little bit of coffee. I don't know if Chemo even drank coffee, but I do know that people were drawn to him. And they would go to R&M Refrigeration, which was, of course, the family business, would go whether or not they needed to go. It was just a welcoming place where they could, you know, be with your dad.
And it still happens. People are still taking their taquitos in the morning and gathering there. And people still remember that. In fact, last night, we went out to dinner to have sushi, and I ran into someone who knew both my brother and my father.
Wow.
And gave me a big hug. And Luis said, oh my goodness, I so loved your brother and your father. Your father's the whole reason that I'm doing what I'm doing, if it wasn't for his support. So when you run into people like that and you hear the stories, you know, and that's happened to me several times where people say, it was your father that inspired me to start my business. Or it was sitting at the counter at R&M where he gave me, you know, a hint of where to go. Or I have found people who have told me that I had no idea about, but who have shared with me that he would very often share funds so that they can go and get their license in air conditioning and that kind of thing.
Wow.
You know, that was, the business was his way of bringing people, you know, that saying of mi casa es su casa.
Mm-hmm.
That was a, you know,
An R&M refrigeration.
R&M refrigeration, yes. That's right. Yeah.
Yes.
You're right. It was home.
Yes. And the R&M was Robledo.
And Mejia.
And Mejia. And Mejia was Javier Urtia Rosa's sister.
Okay.
And she was the one that put up initially some of the resources that were needed to get that business started. After Chemo left the army, and he was in the army for like
eight and a half years.
Yes.
So when did that happen then? It was
so
you would have remembered this when the business was founded, or were you too young?
No. So the business was founded much later.
Okay.
When Dad first came back from the army, he actually worked in maintenance at the university.
Okay.
While working maintenance, decided he would get his license in air conditioning there at ALJC back then. And started doing some work for them, and found he was really good at this. And so he wanted to open up the business. And so my tía helped them financially with the resources to be able to do this. And they started the business in a little home that had two bedrooms, very, very, very small home on Corpus Street. And they converted the front living room of that home into the actual business. So they put up a counter, and we would go, my brother and I, with my mother. My mother became the secretary and treasurer kind of thing, accountant kind of thing, and Dad would run the business. And so we would go, and we would be in the back in one of the bedrooms. And Anselmo was so small that he was in a little playpen when we first started.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. And so how long was the business in that house before it moved into him?
It was actually 8 years before they constructed. They bought the address where they are at. They bought one other home, another lot, took it down and made it a small building, and then expanded it into what it is today. And so it is now half of the block.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So the business, I sense, was very important to your dad. He was very connected to it. Yeah. Yeah, and that was the case throughout the whole time. It was just, I wouldn't typically think of refrigeration as like a vocation, but all the stories I've ever heard make it sound like maybe because of the people and like welcoming people into the space, it felt like it was part of his identity.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really cool. So one of the other themes that we've been kind of touching on over the past few episodes is faith. And sort of religious practice and the religious identity of the family. Was your dad a religious man?
My father was a religious man, but not a practicing Catholic.
Okay.
Like, we would often go to mass with my mother, and my father wouldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother, my grandfather were the ones that really were the essence of our faith building in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
Dad was more of a faithful. He would go at baptisms, that special occasions. Yeah. But
he never had objections then, but he was more of like an observer.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. That's kind of how I grew up with my dad, One never felt that like he was against it, but he just had no interest. Right. Yeah.
I think in Chemo's case, and I never talked to him directly about this. I think I was too small to make sense of what I was hearing. What you told us about the circumstances of your birth and having to come back from Germany and your mom being so sick. One of the stories that I grew up with was the fact that because your mom was so sick that Chemo was told that he might need to choose whether Rosa or Rosita, should be saved. And he was told that he really didn't have a choice, that it was Rosita, the baby, who would be saved even at the loss of her mom, of Rosa. And there's still today something that strikes me as very wrong about that. I don't know from, you know, like from an ethical point of view, you would have many thoughts, both personal and professional, Javier, as a theologian and ethicist about that. But I think that there's something very wrong with telling of a dad, first of all, that he would need to make a decision, and secondly, that really not make a decision because it was already made for him, and he would have to tell the doctor that the daughter was more important. I have a feeling that that soured Chemo's connection or relationship with the church, and how he saw it. He never was against it.
Absolutely not.
Now, why the church, though? Was it a doctor or was it a priest in this story?
It's the priest.
There's the priest.
That presented the dilemma. The priest from Nuevo Laredo.
That's awful. Yeah. Also, like, what does a priest have to do with that moment, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
There was something off about that I think, even in the context of our family, made Chemo a little bit sort of more distant.
Now, did he ever tell you this story himself?
No, I never spoke to him about it. It was one of those things that I just, you know, there's a few things in my life that I wondered about, like, you know, this doesn't make sense.
Sure.
I didn't know about that part, that's a new part of that story. But in reflection of my grandmother, Abuelita Lala was a very, very involved woman in her church. She, I did my first Holy Communion because of her. I became a catechism teacher by the age of 9 because I used to go with Grandma and the Sisters of Mary Help. And, you know, she was just that faith leader in our family. And so I could see where he may have connected, you know, because of her strong, strong faith. And then having had a priest say something like that with the negativism and how that may have pulled him away from the family.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of guessing that may be. I had never heard of that. That's an interesting story.
And Lala went through something not quite the same, but similar in terms of her own loss of faith, right? She lost the taste for faith for a while before, a little bit earlier in her life. In the poem from last episode, there's an allusion to that, which is that the Christ of El Santo Niño Church didn't save her father.
Right.
So there's painful moments.
There's painful moments in all of our lives, you know. And thankfully, they're moments, right?
Exactly.
They're not all of our lives. Yeah. There's painful and joyful moments both.
Yes.
My mom, for a long time, didn't go to church, lost her faith. She loved her dad, my abuelito Anselmo, which is actually
there you go.
Why my brother is called Anselmo, and his son is called Anselmo, and why each of the women in the family who had males had an Anselmo. Was because of my abuelito Chemo.
This is the dad she lost.
Anselmo Benavides. And she lost him, and she loved him, as did all of his daughters, dearly. And so my mother would tell me this. She told me herself that she regained her faith after Lupe, my sister, was born, and there was a lot to deal with in terms of her, you know, her health and everything else. And my dad sort of was pulled by the ear to follow her into, you know, very religious practices that they both engaged in later in life. Right. Certainly for my dad, it was later
life. Yeah.
You know, even if dad was not a practicing Catholic, the faith was still very important for him. And I know that because he made it a point to make sure that we attended Mary Helper Christians.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted that foundation, mm-hmm. you know. So I know that he still carried those teachings. And, you know, although he had a pain there, his faith definitely still carried who he was,
right.
you know, and right. how he wanted to have his children continue living right. that faith.
So he passed it on, even though it wasn't the center of his mm-hmm. own life, mm-hmm. right, in the traditional sense.
Yes.
It's something that, it's not like it skipped a generation, right?
Right.
It was in him somehow, mm-hmm. sounds like you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So what about the end of his life? Because this is where my memory kind of picks up. I remember when he passed away. I remember being in the hospital. Isn't it so that, was it that there was this like a space shuttle disaster mm-hmm. that happened either that very day or the day before? Mm-hmm. Do you remember which mm-hmm. that was?
We were.
Is that Challenger or is that?
The Challenger
yeah.
disaster.
Yeah.
And yes, we were in the hospital and they were showing what was happening on television.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just remember that. I don't know. I mean, that sort of disaster, like a sort of public thing happening, I remember clearly. Maybe that's why the memory is there. But I also remember it was a very positive experience for me, too. I mean, I didn't really know what was going on, but I just remember there being a lot of family. Like that's what always stands out to me, like just being a lot of family around, which in the best of circumstances is how we do things when somebody is passing on.
Right. Or
to the next life,
you know, is in the hospital, yes. like, you know, these signs of like only two people at an time.
He's not yellow. We are as Mexicans. We just, you know.
And maybe, did we bring it up in a previous episode? I was also saying this to some friends recently, how different it is, because down here, like, and it's certainly in Laredo, a funeral home, I mean, they have a kitchen and they have like, tables and they have like food. Whereas in New England, where Ryan and I lived a year and a half ago now, apparently Massachusetts law forbids eating in funeral homes.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, that's crazy.
That's crazy. That's what you do is eat
yeah.
for heaven's sakes when yeah. somebody dies. Mm-hmm. And drink in certain circumstances, you sure. know, sort of like the Irish, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a way of, I think it's a way of dealing with what is going on.
Yeah.
And a way of supporting people, mm-hmm. you know.
And it's also just what you do when you're together.
Yes.
Right? And I think one of the things that I really appreciate about our family and our culture is that death is a time for togetherness.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think many, many other families don't think of it that way. Like death is a time for like, say goodbye and leave it alone
mm-hmm.
and like kind of step away. But the togetherness is what I remember.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yes.
For sure.
The morning that Chemo died, I think he died como en la madrugada, ¿no? And we were at the hospital and I was called in with whoever else was there to say goodbye to your dad. And he was still alive. And I remember Alfredo and I both being there. And your mom, although she might have been gone to sleep for a little while, I don't remember. But I remember being in the room right before he died. And he looked at me and he said, te quiero. And I always, always remember that,
mm-hmm.
you know, like how fortunate I was that I got to hear that. And I had actually seen Chemo like a couple of weeks before he died. There was a menudo, speaking of food, there was a menudo cook-off.
Oh, yes.
In Laredo. And Nora, who worked with one of the courts in Laredo, and her team were making menudo as part of the contest. And so Alfredo was the menudo maker. He made really good menudo. And Lucas thought he had the secret of the greatest menudo in the universe, which I will not tell. but anyway, so we were there. And then Chemo came by. And that was the last time that I saw him. And it was about 2 weeks before he died. He came by, and I remember he, you know, had gotten more used to his leg, which he had lost to diabetes, and had, you know, his help walking.
Mm-hmm. Was he wearing a prosthetic at that time?
He was wearing a prosthetic, and he had a cane to help him.
Yeah.
But he was there, and as usual, you know, he and Alfredo would like, the way that Ismael and Javier do, like, just sort of throw jabs at each other. And they always did that. And so I got to see him, and I got to catch up with him.
Yes.
At that point.
Yeah.
Not knowing, of course, that he would die in 2 weeks, but feeling very fortunate that I was able to be there and that he said, te quiero.
Yes. So you got that moment.
Yes.
Before he passed.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Dad, so 2 years prior, had he lost his leg 4 years before that. And Dad was such a lover of life. He never let anything stop him. And so when they told him, you're going to be in this wheelchair, he would, and he did everything he could to get out of that wheelchair and get into his prosthetic. In fact, he ended up with a wound because he wanted to wear the prosthetic before he was actually ready for it.
So he was pushing it because he wanted to get it.
Yes. The dad never stopped going to R&M, never stopped working. He just kept living life, and he would make sure that everybody knew he was still around, you know? And he would always tell mom, you know, yo me voy a morir trabajando, pero feliz, you know? And when he passed, that's actually pretty much what happened. Dad had gone to work all day, and then I was out to dinner with a friend, and I get a phone call from my mother saying they had just gone to his favorite place, which was Logan's. He loved peanuts.
Oh, really?
Love to crunch on the peanuts.
Oh, Logan's the chain.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Because he loved the peanuts from there. Uh-huh. He used to just love cracking those peanuts and throwing the shelf. And so they had gone to eat, and mom got home, and he went down and said, I don't feel well. And she calls me. I said, Mom, hang up, call 911. We went off. And Dad and I had had an opportunity after he lost his leg to really connect, so that I knew what his wishes were.
Okay.
When the time came, because he would have to come to San Antonio often for the work on his prosthetic. And so I would often bring him for his visits. And so it gave us a lot of time to connect. And so he always told me, I don't want extraordinary means, you know. When it's time, it's time. So the day that we took him to the hospital, he had had a massive heart attack. And he already had in his paperwork a TNR, and he already had in his paperwork, he didn't want any kind of intubation. And I remember talking to him and saying, Dad, please, the doctors are saying, just give me one more chance, and I promise if you code again, we'll disconnect you. And I think he was so desperate to breathe because he couldn't breathe anymore that he allowed them to intubate him.
Mm.
And we called the Anthea, came up. And so as soon as the family knew, that's why you remember so many people there, because as soon as the family knew, everybody just zoomed into the hospital.
Yeah.
The love just poured.
Right.
Poured. And he actually remained in the ER because they didn't have rooms in the ICU for 24 hours. because I was working in the hospital, I was allowed to stay with him.
Oh, wow.
And so we had those 24 hours together. And he, we were, I would ask him questions. And he was, because he was intubated, he couldn't talk, but we were doing the eye blinking, that kind of thing. And then he went into the ICU. And Dia called and you had woken up really early because you had, you were staying at their home. And mom had still stayed asleep, but you called and said, I think I need to come in. I'll never forget that. And you said, I think I need to come in. I said, come, Dia, you know, visiting hours aren't yet, but I'll get you in. I'll get you in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you came in. And you had that wonderful visit with him. And then you stayed around. You were waiting for mom. You had said, a lo mejor vamos a comer un taquito, you know, in the cafeteria. And that day passed. And then the next morning, or really early in the morning, I would sleep on the lounge of the ICU floor. And my friends would allow me to come in and out throughout the night. But in the middle of the night, I heard a code. And so I knew it was him immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ran in and I remember just looking at him and him saying, I said, no more. He said, so signed the paperwork, they extubated him. And then he was able to say, me voy a esperar. And he waited for everybody to get there.
Wow.
He waited for everybody to get there to say goodbye to the people he wanted to say goodbye with. Dia being one of those.
Wow.
Dia being the last person to get there was Anselmo, my brother.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as he saw my brother come in the door, he said the same thing, te quiero, and then he passed.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Full of family.
Full of family, surrounded by
yes.
family. And that theme again of people waiting for the right moment to die.
Yes.
We discussed
yes.
this in an earlier
yes.
In an earlier conversation about how you think, right, Mommy, that perhaps your mother waited to die when Lupe was out of the room because she spent her whole life caring for Lupe and perhaps couldn't bring herself to die in front of Lupe.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether these things are true or not. I just think it's really neat to think of us continuing to make that decision and then these people we love continuing to make that decision to be who they always were.
Mm-hmm.
Even
when dying.
When they're dying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And at moments where we think that there's very little agency left in one, right? Like, so I'm dying. There's very little I can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I want to be able to say goodbye,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's what my dad did also at the MD Anderson.
Yes.
He died the day before Father's Day. In 1980, and Lupe and I and my mom were already there. And then shortly after Chemo and Alfredo got there, my dad died.
Hmm.
And it really was almost like he was just, you know, waiting
yes.
so that everybody, as you said, mija, that he wanted to say goodbye to, you know, he could. And I think that's just wonderful.
Yes.
I think that connects us in ways that we may not even realize,
right.
we may not even know.
You and I have discussed in the past, Mommy, some of the thinking that I've done with my students around death and dying in the courses that I mm-hmm. teach in theology. And one of the ideas that most stood out to me is from a Catholic theologian by the name of Karl Rahner, and he describes death as one of the greatest possible human acts. So rather than thinking of death as something that happens to us, and sometimes it does just happen, right? Not everyone controls the circumstances of their dying, but rather than thinking of death as basically that, a moment in which we're like passive and overwhelmed by something, instead he thinks of death as like this choice, this act that we can make, and we can put ourselves in it, we can put our heart in it, we can think of our loved ones and feel connected to them. And I think that's, again, I think that's really cool. We don't just kind of blink out of existence or fade away or fall apart. We say goodbye. I mean, in the best of circumstances, mm-hmm. we have the opportunity to say goodbye.
Well, and I think it for me, and this I think I learned from Dad, when he would talk about his mother and his father passing, he would always say, "Me rechoca que dicen, I lost him," and he would say it in Spanish, mm-hmm. Se murieron, los perdí. Perdí a mi mamá en tal año. And she goes, ¿qué perdiste si no perdiste nada? He would always say, you didn't really lose anything. You gained everything because they're always with you, mm-hmm. you know? And my father, and I think part of it is you and I had talked about, I don't like cemeteries. Mm. I don't do cemeteries.
Okay.
But because I think...
Well, I'm glad that. I don't do cemeteries.
You will catch me there when they bury the person.
There you go.
That's it. But because I believe that there is an eternal... They're always with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, they've gone to where they need to go.
Yes.
You know, to a non-physical place that I can't share with them. But to me, there's so much more. It's a spirit and who we are as spirit, not... But it's just temporary, you know?
Yes.
It's that spirit. And Dad would always say that. But he also did not like... he didn't do cemeteries.
Oh, so he was the cemeteries very like...
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. No, that was always a point of contention between my parents because my mother was the total opposite. My mother, her parents were buried in Nuevo Laredo and they had these beautiful tombstones with all this white cobble. And they would go every weekend to take out the weeds. And mm-hmm. my father really disliked doing that, but it was something my mother really, really treasured doing for her family because that's how she grew up. So my father would do everything. He would buy the caña and stay in the entrance while my mother went and did whatever she needed to do, you know,
yes, yes.
that kind of thing. And his treat was to go eat taquitos afterwards. And so that's why he did it.
Wow.
You know, but I remember, otra vez, Rosa, y otra vez, Rosa.
Oye, what does that mean, buy the caña?
La caña. So in Nuevo Laredo, they have trucks that have the caña, the sugar cane.
Yes.
On the road before you go in. And a lot of times they use it as offertory for the tombs.
I see.
But a lot of people just buy it to eat, sure. to break it and eat for the pain. And so Dad used to love that. And Mom would always say, vas a dejar los dientes en la caña, en ya no tienes dientes. But that was his treat.
Yes.
That, you know, he was, tú déjame aquí con mi caña, you know. Tú veas lo que tú quieres allá.
You know.
It was just a difference in how they viewed it.
Something, Rosita, you said a second ago about our being... spirit and like how this idea of I lost them doesn't mm-hmm. make sense actually reconnected to me to a quote that I saw earlier this week, which just so happens to be from Karl Rahner, the theologian that I was describing. And it just, you connected, like you said exactly this, and I'd like to read it. It appeared on the page of one of my mentors on Facebook. The quote is this. Karl Rahner says, "The great and sad mistake of many people is to imagine that those whom death has taken leave us. They do not leave us. They remain. Where are they? In the darkness? Oh no. It is we who are in the darkness. We do not see them, but they see us. Their eyes, radiant with glory, are fixed on our eyes. Though invisible to us, they are not absent. They are living near us, transfigured into light, power, and love." I think that's really fabulous. I think
that's beautiful. Light, power, and love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good place for us to conclude. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Rosita. This is really cool. I think this worked out. I think it worked out really well. We accessed part of Theo Chemo and his spirit that we couldn't have done without you, so
you
thanks for doing us that.
Thank you.
The good man, my brother.
Mm. Yes.